Welcome back to this week's Mike Cannon Indie Media Radio Show. Up next, a show I bring you each and every week about this time, This Way Out is an LGBT and teen news magazine. After that, we'll be bringing you Black Agenda Radio, Latin Radical Radio, Peak Oil Check-In, to name a few. That's the type of non-corporate alternative voices you get each and every week right here on The Mike Cannon Show. And as always, thanks for listening.
You take the blue pill, the story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill, you stay in Wonderland, and I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
One of my absolute best friends for the last 30 years, who happens to be gay, and I love her dearly, who happens to have made a choice that isn't a choice that I have made, but I'm not going to judge people.
Certainly I don't know all of the roughly 18,000 that we know of gay people in the state. But the people I know don't call her a friend.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Ecuador's new constitution grants new lesbi-gay rights. Palin's debatable friendships are hometown tested, and crank up the volume while you're dancing out. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Torres.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 4th, 2008. Voters in the South American nation of Ecuador overwhelmingly approved a new constitution this week that guarantees civil rights for gays and lesbians and establishes civil unions for same-gender couples, giving them virtually all the rights of marriage. The nation's 20th constitution also helps leftist president Rafael Correa consolidate power and run for two more consecutive terms. He's a former economics minister and has made the economy a central issue during the first 2 years of his presidency. The new constitution also guarantees free education through college and pensions for stay-at-home mothers. Those provisions build on popular programs already established by Correa to provide low-interest loans for small businesses, building materials for first-time homeowners, and free seeds for growing crops. Opponents worry that Correa's expanded authority will lead to actions similar to those of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. But the Ecuadorian leader has reportedly maintained considerable political distance from Chavez and has no plans to consolidate his powers as much as Chavez has aggressively done.
But Portugal's Prime Minister José Sócrates has rejected proposals to legalize same-gender unions. Two measures to do that are scheduled for debate in Parliament this month. Unlike his socialist counterpart, José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero, who spearheaded marriage equality in neighboring Spain, Sócrates told the Portuguese parliament that homosexual unions are not on the political agenda, repeating what he said 3 years ago during his election campaign. The issue has created sharp divisions among the country's progressive political parties. Greens MP Eloisa Apollonia, who's sponsoring one of two same-gender union proposals, told local media that this country, when it waits for the socialists to promote equality, is always put on hold.
Roman Catholic officials have rejected the first choice of the French government to be the country's ambassador to the Vatican because he's gay. Jean-Luc Condelforge, a career diplomat, is in a civil union with his same-gender partner. The Roman Catholic Church, of course, opposes LGBT rights and any attempts to protect or legally recognize lesbi-gay relationships. According to a report by Agence France-Presse, another candidate was rejected because he's divorced. That apparently didn't stop Pope Benedict XVI when he visited Paris last month from warmly greeting President Nicolas Sarkozy and his new wife, Carla Bruni. Sarkozy divorced his first wife to marry Bruni. France's ambassador to Moscow will take the Vatican post.
But openly gay lawyer and former Olympic fencer Sir Terence Etherton became a member of England's and Wales' second highest court in late September. The 58-year-old Etherton was sworn in as one of 36 judges who serve on the Court of Appeal. He's the first openly gay Lord Justice of Appeal and was formally recommended by Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Etherton told the Independent newspaper that his appointment shows that diversity in sexuality is not a bar to preferment up to the highest levels of the judiciary.
Elsewhere in Europe, the Athens Pride Committee staged a demonstration in front of the Greek Parliament this week in support of the mayor of the Aegean island of Tilos and the two same-gender couples he married in June. They're all in trouble with the court of first instance on the island of Rhodes, especially the mayor. Prosecutors want to nullify the marriages and convict Mayor Anastasios Alaferis of breach of duty, punishable by imprisonment for up to 5 years. Greece's marriage law doesn't specifically prohibit marriage between people of the same gender, but the nation's top public prosecutor, Georgios Tsonidas, has said that a constitutional article relating to family issues implies that marriage is only between a man and a woman.
A court in Rome last week ordered a trial for the two men arrested outside the ancient Colosseum in July 2007 and charged with committing lewd public acts. Defense lawyers for the men, identified only by their first names in media reports, Michelle and Roberto, say that it was just a kiss. The arresting officers claim that the two were engaging in oral sex. The defense team has unsuccessfully sought video footage from nearby security cameras to show that the charges are unwarranted. The prosecuting magistrate claims that the lighting was poor and that the issue was too complex to be judicially relevant. Aurelio Mancuso, who leads one of Italy's major LGBT rights groups, Archigay, told reporters that homosexuality is being punished, not an obscene act. The trial is scheduled to begin in February. The defendants face up to 3 years in prison if they're convicted.
Police in Uganda arrested two high-profile activists described as male-to-female transgender gay and brutally detained them for a week in mid-September, according to a report by the U.S.-based International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, or IGLHRC. Georgina Oundo and Brenda Kiza were taken into custody at Oundo's home near Kampala and held at the Nabweru Village Police Station. IGLHRC says they were beaten, kicked, denied food, and pressured to reveal names and addresses of other LGBT activists. Human Rights Watch has charged that police also copied the activists' cell phone address books. Oundo and Kiza have been accused of spreading homosexuality, although IGLHRC says no such crime exists in the African nation. But consensual adult gay sex is illegal in Uganda and punishable by up to life in prison. Police say that their investigation remains open and that they'll seek additional evidence to bring the activists before a court. In the past 5 years, nearly a dozen people have been arrested on charges related to homosexuality in Uganda.
Meanwhile, some people apparently believe it's still acceptable to call for the deaths of gays and lesbians. In Australia and Canada? The Anti-Discrimination Tribunal in the Australian state of Queensland found Ron Owen, the publisher of an ultra-right-wing pro-militia magazine called Lock, Stock, and Barrel, guilty of inciting hatred against homosexuals for displaying a bumper sticker on his car parked outside government offices near Brisbane that said, "Gay rights, under God's law, the only rights gays have is the right to die." Several local lesbians took Owen to the tribunal, which awarded damages to two of them of $5,000 and a third with $2,500. Tribunal member Daryl Rangia's 77-page decision also ordered Owen, a former local elected official, to publish a written apology. "Ron Owen is entitled to publicly express his homophobic views," he wrote. "That much is required in a society that values freedom of thought and expression. However," Rangia concluded, "there are limits." Owen has vowed to appeal the ruling.
And David Popescu, who's running for a seat in the Canadian Parliament, told a candidates' forum held for students at Sudbury Secondary School in the province of Ontario that homosexuals should be executed. Police are investigating his remarks under Canada's hate crime law, which makes it a federal offense to promote hatred or incite violence against minorities, including gays and lesbians. Popescu acknowledged making the comments in an interview with the Sudbury Star newspaper. "A young man asked me what I think of homosexual marriages, and I said I think homosexuals should be executed," he said. "My whole reason for running is the Bible, and the Bible couldn't be more clear on that point." Canadians go to the polls on October 14th to elect a new government.
A gay and lesbian film festival scheduled to open in the Russian city of St. Petersburg this week was shut down before it could begin, after fire inspectors claimed that the two venues hosting it were unsafe. The scheduled four-day festival, called Side by Side, was to show 17 feature films and 5 shorts in 2 nightclubs, The Place and Sochi, each popular with students, artists, and expats. A number of filmmakers from the U.S. and Europe, including John Cameron Mitchell, best known for Hedwig and the Angry Inch and Short Bus, were also scheduled to make personal appearances during the screenings. Organizers had moved the festival to the two nightclubs a month earlier, after the original venue terminated their contract for what they called technical reasons. Irina Sergeyeva, one of the three organizers of the festival, told the St. Petersburg Times that they were indignant, upset, and distressed, and implied that local officials had orchestrated the shutdown.
And finally, a much-anticipated film chronicling the life of San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk from openly gay director Gus Van Sant and starring Sean Penn in the title role is scheduled to be released in December. But California's Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has vetoed a bill written by openly gay assemblyman Mark Leno of San Francisco that would have designated May 22nd, Milk's birthday, as a statewide Day of Significance. Schwarzenegger has signed several pieces of pro-LGBT legislation during his tenure, but vetoed two marriage equality bills passed by the legislature. He is nevertheless publicly opposing a November ballot measure to revoke that right ordered by the state Supreme Court in May. Harvey Milk was one of the first openly gay men in the U.S. to be elected to public office as a San Francisco supervisor in 1977. He and then-Mayor George Moscone were assassinated by Dan White, a disgruntled right-wing former supervisor, in 1978. By refusing to sign the bill honoring Milk, Schwarzenegger apparently bowed to right-wing groups that had mounted a massive Contact the Governor campaign against it. In his veto message, Schwarzenegger said that Milk should continue to be recognized at the local level.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 4th, 2008, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Michael LeBeau.
And I'm John Torres.
Can the GOP's vice presidential nominee make the Democrats' lesbi-gay supportive record seem pale in comparison? We'll let you decide after this important message.
We've got good news, bad news, and good news about your favorite international LGBT radio program. The good news is that you can now hear free podcasts of This Way Out. To subscribe, log on to www.thiswayout.org. The bad news is that we're still owed thousands of dollars from our former online outlet, and that puts This Way Out in serious financial jeopardy. Stations get the program from us for free. You can get the podcast for free. We're also free of corporate sponsors. Producing and distributing the program, however, is not free. But the other good news is that This Way Out's unique on-the-scene reports covering the fight for same-gender marriage equality, from the world's first legal weddings in the Netherlands to the victories in Canada, Massachusetts, and California, are now available in a 2-CD collection called Altard States. This Way Out listener supporters can get this and other special programs by visiting our website. Please say, I do, at www.thiswayout.org.
In the U.S. this week, the headline-making machine belonged to Republican vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. First, the Alaska governor drew a low score in another big network news interview. That questionable outing set the stage for Palin's only shot at her Democratic counterpart, Senator Joe Biden, in a one-on-one debate. Then, against the backdrop of her lesbi-gay-related comments at those events, a major queer advocacy group revealed the Palin-related sentiments of LGBT activists in her own hometown. Palin has mostly been shielded from the press, so every word counted when she met up with CBS's Katie Couric. Few of those words counted in her favor, as she failed to recall any significant Supreme Court rulings other than the pro-choice landmark Roe v. Wade, and then couldn't name any news publications she regularly reads. Couric also zeroed in on Palin's religious views and how they affect her position on LGBT civil rights.
The governor told us, though she's not a member of any church, she visits a couple of them regularly when she's home. She took issue with news reports that one of them, the Wasilla Bible Church, sponsored a conference where gays could be made straight through prayer.
When the media gets it wrong, it frustrates Americans who are just trying to get the facts and be able to make up their mind on about a person's values. And, you know, I don't know what prayers are worthy of being prayed, and I don't know what prayers are going to be answered or not answered. But as for homosexuality, I am not going to judge Americans and the decisions that they make in their adult personal relationships. I have one of my absolute best friends for the last 30 years who happens to be gay, and I love her dearly, and she is not my gay friend. She is one of my best friends who happens to have made a choice that isn't a choice that I have made, but I'm not going to judge people.
More people tuned in for the October 2nd Palin-Biden debate than watched the first contest between presidential candidates John McCain and Barack Obama the previous week. Moderator Gwen Ifill asked Biden to compare his stance on same-gender couples benefits to Alaska's law granting them. But Ifill first erroneously implied that Palin had supported those benefits, which started the music for the dance she was able to do around the question.
Do you support, as they do in Alaska, granting same-sex benefits to couples?
Absolutely. Do I support granting same-sex benefits? Absolutely, positively. Look, in an Obama-Biden administration, there will be absolutely no distinction from a constitutional standpoint or a legal standpoint between a same-sex and a heterosexual couple. The fact of the matter is that under the Constitution, we should be granted, same-sex couples should be able to have visitation rights in the hospital, joint ownership of property, life insurance policies, etc. That's only fair. It's what the Constitution calls for. And so we do support making sure that committed couples in the same-sex marriage are guaranteed the same constitutional benefits as it relates to their property rights, their rights of visitation, their rights of insurance, their rights of ownership, as heterosexual couples do.
Governor, would you support expanding that beyond Alaska to the rest of the nation?
Well, not if it goes closer and closer towards redefining the traditional definition of marriage between one man and one woman. And unfortunately, that's sometimes where those steps lead. But I also want to clarify, if there's any kind of suggestion at all from my answer, that I would be anything but tolerant of adults in America choosing their partners, choosing relationships they deem best for themselves. You know, I am tolerant, and I have a very diverse family and group of friends, and even within that group, you would see some who may not agree with me on this issue, some very dear friends who don't agree with me on this issue. But in that tolerance also, no one would ever propose, not in a McCain-Palin administration, to do anything to prohibit, say, visitations in a hospital or contracts being signed, negotiated between parties. But I will tell Americans straight up that I don't support defining marriage as anything but between one man and one woman. And I think through nuances, we could go round and round about what that actually means. But I'm being as straight up with Americans as I can in my non-support for anything but a traditional definition of marriage.
Let's try to avoid nuance, Senator. Do you support gay marriage?
No, Barack Obama nor I support redefining from a civil side what constitutes marriage. We do not support that. That is basically a decision to be able to be left to the faith and people who practice their faith, the determination what you call it. The bottom line, though, is, and I'm glad to hear the governor, I take her at her word, obviously, that she thinks there should be no civil rights distinction, none whatsoever, between a committed gay couple and a committed heterosexual couple. If that's the case, we really don't have a difference.
Is that what you said?
Your question to him was whether he supported gay marriage, and my answer is the same as his, and it is that I do not.
Wonderful. You agree. On that note, let's move to foreign policy.
Palin's contention that some of her best friends are raised the curiosity of the Human Rights Campaign. The advocacy organization sent staff member Michael Cole to Wasilla, Alaska, in search of LGBT activists in the governor's hometown.
To be honest, I didn't expect to find many gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender people in Wasilla, but we met dozens in the small town. Unfortunately, many were afraid to be on camera.
primarily because of this vice presidential nomination. And I teach 400 plus children, every kiddo that goes to my school. And all it takes is one family to make life very difficult.
What people told me is that Wasilla wasn't always like this. The two powerful churches that Sarah Palin has belonged to turned their fundamentalist ideology into a political mission, and life changed here.
Sarah was a member of the Assembly of God Church in Wasilla, which are pretty much the most fundamentalist anti-gay groups in Alaska.
They became very politically active, and Sarah was a part of that movement.
There was a huge influence of religion, and that's really across the state. In Wasilla, in terms of Sarah Palin, I know that she put a lot of people in position who are associated with her church.
Certainly we have religious freedom in this country, thank goodness, but it seemed oftentimes that her religious values intersected oftentimes with her role in the state and her role as mayor.
In the scandal over banning books at the town library, the right wing started exerting their newfound power.
When Sarah became mayor, the way she tells the story, she was just asking rhetorical questions of the library about censorship. But this was while the church was actively picketing to have several gay children's books removed from the shelves. Pastor, I Am Gay was one of the books that the Assembly of God Church wanted to get off the shelves and lock up, and that Sarah Palin wanted to get off the shelves and lock up.
When we put them in the Wasilla Library, the first two copies just disappeared. You know? And so we put more in, and we know that on three occasions she talked to the librarian about removing certain books.
For the folks I met, the thing that scares them most are the infamous ex-gay ministries.
You know, she comes from a religious ideology and a church organization that supports conversion therapy or reparative therapy. And as a therapist, the thought of someone at that high a level who supports that is terrifying.
Her church was one of the sponsors of a recent conference in Anchorage about changing homosexuals to heterosexuals through prayer. I have a lot of friends who have gone through the torture of change, you know, programs. They're awful. They're cruel.
I pray about that a lot because her concept of, quote, family values, unquote, is just so anathema to the idea that gay and lesbian people have a right to exist, that we have a right to live as decent, common folks.
Despite all of this, Sarah Palin has said she has gay friends.
I know there have been rumors that, you know, she has gay friends here and is gay friendly, and certainly I don't know all of the roughly 18,000 that we know of gay people in the state, but the people I know don't call her a friend.
I think we need to be a community. We need to be, you know, united in this. Have to just put our foot down and say we're not going to accept it. We're not going to accept being marginalized or made second-class people.
That's my experience of her as a mayor. She does the same thing as a governor for the state, and it scares the crap out of me what might happen if she becomes the vice president. Because she'll do it to the country. I mean, I think she's worse than Dick Cheney and a better shot.
I'm coming out against Sarah Palin.
I am coming out against Sarah Palin.
I'm coming out against Sarah Palin.
I am as opposed to the election of Sarah Palin as a person can be.
The Human Rights Campaign's Michael Cole spoke with activists Jamie Rodriguez and Breon Lyons, Pastor I Am Gay author Reverend Howard Bess, Dr. Marky Bloomer, and an anonymous teacher in Governor Sarah Palin's Wasilla, Alaska. For more information, log on to www.hrc.org. And speaking of coming out, the big day for it is October 11th. The 20th annual National Coming Out Day commemorates the 1987 National March on Washington for LGBT rights. Gay radio producer Buddy Johnston brewed this tuneful coming out mix featuring organizer-entertainer Robin Tyler and assassinated San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk.
Shatter them. We must continue to speak out, and most importantly, every gay person must come out.
Harvey, do you have a few words for KBFN?
Come on out. Join us. Tell your immediate family, you must tell your relatives, you must tell your friends if indeed they are your friends, you must tell your neighbors, you must tell the people you work with, you must tell the people in the stores you shop in. Once they realize that we are indeed their children and we are indeed everywhere, every myth, every lie, every innuendo will be destroyed once and for all. People all over this country to do one thing. Come out! Come out, America! Come out!
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Michael LeBeau, John Torres, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Sherry Lund contributed program material. You heard a special mix by Buddy Johnston of Pamela Stanley singing Coming Out of Hiding, with our thanks to J.D. Doyle, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to subscribe to podcasts of your favorite international LGBT radio show. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of our programs and support our work there. To receive our weekly program email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on 5CST Southwest Adelaide, South Australia, Radio Veronica, West Point, Pennsylvania, WWUH, West Hartford, Connecticut, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This is 93.3 WNRB LP Wausau. Free people, free radio. We say free people, free radio, because in the Hmong language, Hmong means free people. And it is the Was Area Hmong Mutual Association that has been kind enough to put up with all the trials and tribulations associated with hosting a not-for-profit community radio station like ours, WNRB-LP. The WNRB-LP studios is located in the Was Area Hmong Mutual Association building on 6th Street, kitty corner from Angelo's Pizza. If you'd like to contact the powers to be at the station, you can do so by writing us at wnrb-lp@hotmail.com. That's wnrb-lp@hotmail.com. Now back to our programming.
Heads up.
Governor Palin, you've been quoted as saying the Earth is only 6,000 years old and man and dinosaurs coexisted.
That's right. I think it was something like this.
Sarah, where's my dinner?
Just a minute, Fred. I gotta finish vacuuming with my mastodon. You're a good dinosaur. Boy, it sure will be super when Jesus is born in 4,000 years.
Yabba-dabba-doo. Jesus died for you.
My hatred for the American government. I've got no use for America. These are quotes from the founder of the Alaskan Independence Party. Sarah Palin and her husband were members of this anti-American organization which supported separation of their state from the United States.
I'm Governor Sarah Palin, and I am delighted to welcome you to the 2008 Alaskan Independence Party Convention.
Does this represent your view, your America? Sarah Palin, a heartbeat away from the presidency.
Public broadcasting black news personality Gwen Ifill caught a bunch of flack from the right when she was tapped to moderate the Sarah Palin-Joe Biden vice presidential debate. The Republicans excel at psychological warfare. They knew that by questioning Ifill's objectivity, by suggesting she harbors a pro-democratic bias, they could cause her to give their not-too-bright would-be VP, Palin, a free ride. It worked. Whatever they paid Ifill was too much. If a moderator can't even request that a candidate respond to questions, what good is she? But then, I've long questioned Gwen Ifill's usefulness to the service of truth in general and black people's interests in particular. The Republicans threw Ifill off her game by charging that she has a monetary interest in a Democratic victory in November when her book, titled Breakthrough, Politics and Race in the Age of Obama, hits the stores. By that standard, journalists who write books about politicians would be disqualified from doing news stories about or moderating interviews with politicians. The whole notion would be silly, except for the fact that it turned Ifill into a useless lump on the screen. Ifill's book should get good reviews, since her line on race is also shared by much of white corporate media. Ifill focuses on Barack Obama, Colin Powell, Newark Mayor Cory Booker, Alabama Congressman Arturo Davis, and Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. These are the breakthrough politicians whose success proves that blacks are well on the way to achieving racial equality, according to Ifill. That view is also widely held at places like the New York Times and among most corporate broadcasters outside of Fox News. So Ifill fits right in. Corporate media reporters seem to share the same list of the good black politicians who speak their language and don't upset white folks, unlike the Reverends Al and Jesse and those poor souls who are still supposedly trapped in the 60s. Gwen Ifill is around to assure her white colleagues that there are black people who agree with them. For this, she is trusted and rewarded. White favor is that special something that Ifill shares with the six black politicians featured in her book. All are decidedly to the right of the black political spectrum, which should, logically, disqualify them from being considered as black leaders. But they are Ifill's soulmates, floating, like her, on a carpet of white media approval, which, in the twisted logic of the post-civil rights era, is the equivalent of black success. In truth, these politicians' primary usefulness is to provide an amen corner for rich white people's critiques of black people. Every Friday evening, Gwen Ifill hosts a little get-together of corporate media buddies called Washington Week. It is a celebration of shared world views. Time magazine concurs with the New York Times, which agrees with the Washington Post, which is pleased to share the same opinion as Newsweek, and so on. At the center of this table is Ms. Eiffel, who agrees with them all. She is the hostess of Perfect Corporate Conformity, which is her personal and professional breakthrough. Gwen Eiffel has a lesson for young black people. Don't fight the power. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
The Jericho Movement first action was a march in Washington, D.C. 10 years ago. Chief Bill Tyak of the Piscataway Nation had ceremoniously permitted the Jericho Movement to speak on the land he says is owned by indigenous peoples. For defending their land, men like Leonard Peltier still sit in jail.
Well, the other two people were tried too, but they were found not guilty for a reason of self-defense. Leonard allegedly killed two FBI agents. They picked out a hater of Indians to be the judge. Later on, they found out that the bullet didn't even fit the gun. The head of the FBI said they don't know who did it. Every time Leonard comes up for parole, they say, we know they were killed on Indian land, and we know an Indian did it. And as far as we're concerned, Mr. Peltier, you're that Indian.
Mama Ialua Ferguson spoke of those members of the Black Panthers and Black Liberation Army who paid a dear price for resisting state oppression.
Rochelle McGee has been acquitted by a jury, but a judge said no, he can't go free. Sunyata Coley, Jaleel Muntagim, Herman Bell became targets of the government's ire back in the 60s and the 70s when they decided that they were not going to stand still and watch the government wipe out our people. Sekou Odinga, Mutulu, they fought for us. And this is why they are sitting behind bars today after 30 years. But if you've ever had the blessing and the privilege to visit them, you come away with so much more strength than all of us put together have. These brothers and sisters have not stopped fighting.
Also during the 60s, young men and women struggled for the independence of Puerto Rico, one of the last United States colonies. Dulcia Pagan was among a handful freed in the late 90s, and speaking to the many young people in the crowd, she vowed never to give up.
I honor my comrade, Carlos Alberto Torres. He's done 28 years. Oscar Lopez Rivera, 27 years. Aiden Beltran, 27 years. She's here now. Avelino Gonzalez was just arrested. Former machetero, he was in clandestinity 23 years, and U.S. imperialists couldn't get him. My nation has now been invaded by the FBI. They assassinated Feliberto, thinking they would kill our movement, where they were contrary wrong. The Puerto Rican movement continues the struggle forward, because until our nations are free, until our political prisoners are home, we are not a people of freedom.
People who took action against state oppression have often been criminalized. A younger generation of anarchists and animal rights and environmental activists are beginning to join ranks with the Jericho Movement. James Pickering is a member of the Earth Liberation Front.
In the late 1990s, the FBI was saying that the Earth Liberation Front was the number one domestic terrorist in the United States. But in the late 60s, they were saying the exact same thing about the Black Panther Party. And every organized group that gets dedicated to fighting this system, Daniel, Marie, Jonathan, Joanna, Jeff, Nathan, and unknown others fought because the government and corporations were lying about global warming. They're destroying our world so that they can get rich while we suffer. Does that sound familiar?
For the WBI Sunday News in Harlem, New York, this is Fred Nguyen.
You know you only had one shot to make it right, to do the right thing. So listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
No dejaremos que cierren la linda puerta que siempre ha estado abierta a la vida.
You're listening to Latin Radical with Warwick Fry.
Lara Pullen in Canberra is going to tell us a little bit about what the Minister for Foreign Affairs from El Salvador said last week in the United States.
Hi, Warwick.
I guess the most important thing is that very interestingly, after the recent discussions that the United States Solidarity Groups had in El Salvador with the ambassador from the United States to El Salvador, where the United States admitted its previous interference in internal affairs of El Salvador, the interesting turnaround to that, where I believe he undertook to that visiting foreign delegation, and you reported on Radio NIM FM that he had given an undertaking that this time around the United States would not be looking at direct interference or even indirect, if you like, interference that could be attributable to the United States in the coming Salvadoran elections. So when you then have the foreign minister of the nation, Marisol Argueta, going before the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., specifically asking for United States intervention, I guess that's put that ambassador in an interesting situation now.
And what else is happening, you know, in the election lead-up?
Well, I think that at the moment it's come to an interesting conjuncture with these comments by Minister Argueta, not just comments but appeal for United States intervention. I mean, she specifically put to the United States, to the Conservative American Enterprise Institute in Washington, that the proposition that losing in El Salvador would be not just devastating for the security and national interests of the oligarchy within El Salvador, but also for the United States. She indicated to the United States that their own security interests would be at stake. And if we have a look just quickly at some of those interests, would be the ongoing military and policing arrangements for the whole of Latin America, which they've headquartered in El Salvador, on the base that they have close to the international airport there near San Salvador. So that's a pretty big a big call that she's put out there, you know, from one fascist right-wing government to the supporting interests in neighbouring imperialist United States.
No, I gather from your language there, Lara, that you don't think there's much content in these claims.
Well, I think that the right wing are very clear about the implications of the change of power that looks set to happen in El Salvador. I mean, the people of El Salvador are clearly and consistently voting and indicating their voting intentions for the left in El Salvador. Mm. All of the opinion polls that are being conducted for left, right, and neutral, if you like, in inverted commas, forces, usually by big commercial polling companies, they're all indicating that there'll be a transition. There needs to be a change of power in those elections. The voter intentions are very clearly aligned with the FMLN candidates and the left. People want a change in El Salvador. In the words of Marisol Argueta, she's saying El Salvador will be the next populist failure in the hemisphere. But if we take that out of the rights language and look at what's happening across the whole of the continent, what it means is El Salvador is the next country to have that red tide, a red wave of change sweep over it. And it's, you know, it's been very clearly indicated. And, of course, the fascist and imperialist forces are not very happy with this move towards socialism across the continent, which is the only sustainable way forward for the continent, according to the people that are actually, you know, there at the grassroots up building this change.
So you'd be saying that this is a popular rather than a populist wave of change?
Well, both, if you like, but she's only talking about it in the context of populist being failures, I guess. I mean, I wouldn't worry too much about the language there. It's about the perspective of you've got a few people that comprise the ruling class there at the moment and the traditional oligarchy there, which are very closely linked to US imperialism and US hegemony. And they are going to lose that power if democratic processes are followed. They need to resort to repressive measures to be able to try to keep power, or fraudulent or other methods. And that's why the FMLN has consistently been putting forward the need, particularly to utilise existing legislative mechanisms that allow international observers to the elections. So national observers aren't allowed, but international observers are.
In a way, they're pulling out all the stop in the probability of an electoral defeat.
Yes, that's right. I mean, the thing is that at the moment in El Salvador, the ruling class there, these are the people that lost the civil war, and I say lost because they were forced to sign a peace agreement, which they certainly did not want to sign. Now, that agreement allowed for the allowed political space for the conversion of the guerrilla movement there into the legitimate civil political opposition that has developed and strengthened since the end of the civil war. They've been the single consistently largest elected representative in the national parliament. However, the coalition of right-wing forces has managed to maintain a sufficient majority to not be able to allow the FMLN to rule. But in their own right, they're the single biggest party represented in the federal parliament. And if it hadn't been for the US intervention at each election, then every analyst has consistently said there would have been an FMLN president by now. This is the third cycle of presidential elections, the third one since the peace accords were signed. So the FMLN did very well in the previous two, but you'll recall that the United States in particular had threatened pretty severe economic sanctions against El Salvador, very severe economic consequences if the people voted for their FMLN president, and it was sufficient to scare the population. I think that with the time that has passed since those threats were made and the severe effects of living under neoliberal economic measures has shown in any case that the country is not going forward at the rate that its citizens would like. It's fairly well developed for where it's placed, you know, and for the consequences of the war and the post-war development of the country. But at the same time, there are huge extremes and inequalities still present within the country. And even within the middle class, their aspirations are not being met. The cost of living is something that they're very mindful of. And it's something that can only be changed by a change of government that's going to put the people's needs before that profit for that tiny minority in the oligarchy.
Is there any more recent news? The levels of political violence were climbing the last time we spoke.
That's so alarming that all of the political parties have actually been called together under the Salvadoran Human Rights Defenders Office, part of the Attorney General's sort of structure within El Salvador, to sign a pact of non-aggression, to agree to limit or agree to deter political violence for the remainder of the election campaign. That's a very important pact that they've agreed to sign. Now, some of the cynics will say, well, yes, the Arena Party also signed the peace accords and haven't complied with many terms and conditions over the last 15 years of those accords. And that's where the international monitoring again becomes very important, and it's where a number of the left parties and the civil organisations have repeatedly requested further United Nations monitoring. That is, while there may be lots of criticism and debate about the role of the United Nations, it's a clear area that they can actually provide some support. And there's still, I think, I guess it's fair to say, a level of resentment and concern amongst some of the civil organisations at how quickly the United Nations pulled out of El Salvador post-conflict, especially given the depth of that conflict. And there is a request that they assist in ensuring a peaceful transition of power following these elections, which, as you know, have already been, contrary to the constitution, they've already been separated into a January and a March round of elections rather than one simple round, which would be far more equitable and affordable for the country.
Well, thanks very much, Lara, for bringing us up to date on that situation in El Salvador and for Community Radio. I'm sure we'll be talking to each other again.
Thanks, Warwick. And people can check your website, I think the Latin Radical website, for links to further information on how they can help with ensuring some transparency during these elections.
Mogadishu, the capital of Somalia, has ceased to exist as a city. Inhabited by nearly 3 million people less than 2 years ago, and still home to more than 1 million 9 months ago, Mogadishu has been virtually emptied of civilians. Whole sections have been leveled, according to the BBC, in what Human Rights Watch calls the most ignored tragedy in the world today. Ignored, that is, by the American and most of the world's media. A lone reporter for the BBC described neighborhoods as having been systematically leveled in desperate battles between resistance fighters and Ethiopian occupation soldiers and their allies. Human Rights Watch says the world would be shocked at the devastation and the plight of Somalia's people, millions of whom are now refugees, stalked, bombed, and besieged in the desolate southern Somali countryside. A year ago, United Nations officials declared that Somalia was the worst humanitarian crisis in Africa, more dire than Darfur. And in May, Amnesty International released a report charging Somali civilians were routinely targeted for attack, mainly by the Ethiopian occupiers and soldiers of the rump Somali government imposed by the Ethiopians. Why have the world media all but ignored the destruction of a capital city and the death and dispersal of its people? Racism is, of course, the paramount reason. Europeans and Americans absolve themselves of guilt for their centuries of rapacious exploitation of the African continent by turning the historical crime upside down. Africans, they say, are savages who cannot help but kill each other. Therefore, that's not news. But the carnage in Somalia that has emptied Mogadishu is a direct consequence of American policy. Washington's so-called war on terror, which is really an endless war against peace. In December 2006, the U.S. encouraged its ally, the Ethiopian dictatorship, to stamp out peace in neighboring Somalia, where Muslim courts had established relative stability for the first time since Somalia fell into chaos in 1991. The U.S. lavished weapons on the Ethiopian army, placing American advisors down to the company level. When the U.S. gave the word, the Ethiopians attacked, backed by American air and naval power. Washington claimed the Somalis had been infiltrated by Al-Qaeda, and with Ethiopia, they installed a Somali government to their own liking. It is a puny regime that could not last a week without Ethiopian and U.S. support, and which has presided over the demise of Somalia's great and once beautiful city, Mogadishu. The world media ignore the leveling of Mogadishu because it is an American crime, and Washington prefers the victim die in silence. Certainly, the U.S. State Department, which leads the corporate press corps around by the nose, is not encouraging anyone to visit what's left of Mogadishu, although they are eager to facilitate visits to Darfur. Black America's celebrated son of Africa, Barack Obama, has had nothing to say about the nightmare that the Bush regime has inflicted on Somalia, and which he will inherit if elected in November. Or maybe his silence speaks for itself. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show.
Eco Oil Check-In. Exploring the end of the age of oil.
As world oil production peaks and declines, the U.S. won't have the oil to fuel all the traveling we do today. That's serious news for car travel. Among the responses that are commonly discussed are more public transit, carpooling and car sharing, traveling less, and better facilities for bicycles. A huge percentage of trips in cars are under 2 miles or otherwise short enough to be easily accomplished on a bicycle. Here in Vermont, though, a lot of people don't like the idea of exposing themselves to the winds and snows of winter on a bicycle. And a rain can put a damper on riding to work in just about any climate. Here's an area where changing technology can make a difference. Velomobiles are a type of pedal-powered vehicle that could change many people's minds about pedaling themselves to work or to the store. Velomobiles are pedal-powered vehicles enclosed with a fairing. They are generally recumbent bicycles or tricycles. That is, you sit or lie with your feet well in front of you in a very comfortable and aerodynamic position. Some velomobiles even have a small electric or gasoline motor to provide extra power, especially for the hills. Even a front fairing alone can make a big difference aerodynamically. Years ago, I built a front fairing for my recumbent bicycle. It sped me up a lot on the flat and downhill, and it was light enough that it didn't slow me down too much going uphill in the gently rolling part of Wisconsin I lived in at the time. As a bonus, it kept me dry from the chest down during rainstorms. Fully enclosed velomobiles offer complete weather protection to the rider as well as the vehicle. If you're riding a bike in the snow, the moving parts and brakes can rust quickly from all the salt and the gunk that gets on them. Velomobiles can keep those parts out of the weather, extending their lives. Regardless of whether they have a fairing, recumbent bicycles and tricycles are much more comfortable than their diamond frame cousins. With no weight on my hands, with my butt on a nice wide seat, and my head in a much more natural position than it is when I lean over the handlebars of a diamond frame bicycle, I can ride for hours in comfort. Because of lingering effects of carpal tunnel syndrome, I get tingling and pain in my hands after 20 miles or so on a diamond frame bike, like my mountain bike. I've twice ridden 300 kilometers or 186 miles on a group ride on a recumbent bike, with nary a pain in my hand or neck, during or afterwards. Because of their comfort, many people who have stopped bicycling find themselves enthusiastic about biking again when they discover recumbents. And recumbents are so much fun to ride. I found myself doubling the miles I rode each year after I got my first bent. I got an indication this past weekend of how non-riders are also much more open to velomobiles than to ordinary bicycles. Recumbent and velomobile riders from around the Northeast gathered in Burlington, Vermont, to show each other their rides and have fun together this weekend. The organizers of the event, the HPV Burlington Bike Fest, that's the human-powered vehicle, Burlington Bike Fest, planned a ride to Shelburne Farms, a farm and educational center south of Burlington. Shelburne Farms apparently has a policy of not allowing bicycles on the property, or at least not groups of bicycles. A representative of the Bike Fest called them and was turned down. They think the roads are too narrow for bicycles at Shelburne Farms. I can't figure that one out since cars are wider than bicycles, but never mind. HPV Burlington Bike Fest chief organizer Phil Hammersluff found out what had happened, and Phil called the Shelburne Farms hostess. "I know," she said. "You want to know why we don't allow bicycles here?" "No," replied Phil. "I want you to understand that we're not bicycles. We're velomobiles. I'll send you pictures." 20 minutes later, she called Phil back and said, "Well, yes, of course, the velomobiles are welcome here." Just do a search for Velomobile, V-E-L-O, mobile, on the internet. You'll be able to find some pictures yourself. Anyway, I notice a lot more people cycling, summer and winter, than 10 years ago. As oil supplies dwindle and the economy contracts, I expect to see a lot more. Recumbent bicycles, tricycles, and the enclosed Velomobiles offer a comfortable and stylish alternative to people getting out of their cars and onto or into conventional bicycles, which I like quite a bit too, by the way. I'm Carl Ettenayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
Let's take a break from squash and talk about beets. Beets, I know, a lot of people hate you, but I'm bringing you back. Like any fruit or vegetable which leave red and purple stains behind everywhere they go, beets contain lots of antioxidants and have great cancer-fighting powers. Studies suggest that beets are particularly effective in preventing colon cancer. Beets contain high amounts of folate and potassium, as well as fiber and vitamin C. Beets have a naturally high sugar content given their relatively low calorie count, about 75 calories per cup, and this makes them pair really well with citrus and tropical flavors such as oranges and passion fruit. It also helps them turn sweet, rich, and buttery when they are cooked. I like to prepare beets as simply as possible. They really couldn't be easier. Just give them a scrub, trim the tops and roots, and wrap them in some foil and bake for about half an hour depending on their size. They are also great steamed.
You don't even have to peel them first. When the beets are cooked, the skins will simply slip off. To avoid purple fingertips, wear some latex kitchen gloves when handling beets. Beets are great hot, cold, or at room temperature. Whichever way you choose, they only need a drizzle of extra virgin olive oil and a sprinkling of salt and pepper. Other great beet toppers are goat cheese, walnuts, and of course, the fruits we mentioned earlier. And beets are amazing when they are pickled. Pickled beets make a great accompaniment to any salad or charcuterie plate. And of course, beet greens are also edible. Did you know Swiss chard and beets are variations of the same leafy green family? Beet greens can be prepared just like spinach or any other big leafy green. Pork products always come to mind for me, but I suppose that's a subject for another day. From RestaurantWidow.com, I'm Lisa the Waitress, and you've been listening to In Season with Lisa on WCRS, LPFM, 102.1 and 98.3, Columbus Community Radio.